The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the H.J. Heinz Company Foundation. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music.
Actually, when you're bending the notes, that's part of using a harmonica to imitate the voice and, or to give the instrument a vocal quality, you know, and making the harmonica sing.
I'm Paul Anthony. This time on The Nature of Music, we'll ask questions about musical instruments, how they affect the music, and how they act as extensions of the human body. Concert pianist Santiago Rodriguez demonstrates how he overcomes the inhuman design of the piano. Conductor Michael Tilson Thomas tells how he makes music through the medium of an orchestra. And blues harpist Phil Wiggins shows how the microphone is an extension of his harmonica.
Let us talk now a bit about the use of a microphone and the playing of this instrument. I've seen some harp players who literally hold the microphone next to their hand, next to the harmonica, and all of it up to their face in order to get the right movement. Mm-hmm. What are the technical reasons for doing that, first of all?
Okay, well, I guess originally, you know, I'm just amplifying the harmonica as well as the guitar was just to make it louder, to play in bigger places, noisier places, and so forth. I think that what they discovered was that with amplifying, a whole lot of other things started to happen too, like you get distortion and you know, and feedback and things like that.
Is that good?
It's good because I mean, at first it happened by accident, but someone said, "Hey, that's a nice sound. You know, let's refine that." You know, and I think that's how it happened.
Right. It's part of the Afro-American aesthetic. You might notice in Africa there are a lot of instruments like harps or thumb pianos, and right on the resonating body, the box of the instrument, someone has taken some nails and put in some bottle caps or something like that to give it a nice rattling sound. And in fact, when you overdrive a tube amplifier, you get a sound pretty much like that, like a blues shouter would want to do.
Okay, I'll play a little bit of a song that I wrote with John Cephas called Burn Your Bridges. It's an instrumental song.
Blues harpist Phil Wiggins using a microphone and amplifier to change the sound of his instrument. The other voice we heard was Michael Licht, blues historian at the Library of Congress. This is The Nature of Music, and we're talking about musical instruments as tools, as devices which allow us to make music faster, louder, higher. Things which alter our God-given capabilities to make music. The question is, how do the characteristics of each instrument affect the music as it passes through that instrument? Let's talk about ergonomics. You know, when you sit in the driver's seat of a well-designed car and all those switches and dials are just in the right place, it feels so comfortable to use, doesn't it? Whoever invented the piano, though, never thought of ergonomics. Musicologist Josef Pacholczyk.
For mortals, this box is a torture box. Why? Because the person who is sitting by the piano is sitting stationary. And he is sitting sort of in the middle of the keyboard. And the hands are of the fixed length. And the reach for the top part of the keyboard and the bottom part of the keyboard are different. He has to stretch, he has to change his position of hands in order to be able to reach those places. So the keyboard is anti-physiological.
Concert pianist Santiago Rodriguez agrees that the piano is a torture box, that it's anti-physiological.
We are always trying to conquer something that is not there, which is comfort at playing the instrument. You get comfortable with the more years you do it. But every day you sit down, and how come even Busoni had to say, he wrote to a friend and he said, I'm still practicing the same little Chopin waltz I was practicing 45 years ago. Now, how could a great man like Busoni have to practice a little Chopin waltz? Because the finger, as unnaturally as we might train it, is still unnatural. Our problem with the piano and the way we have to deal about it muscularly is that tone-wise, the tone begins to decay the minute you play it. That's the loudest that tone will ever go, no matter how soft I play. That one begins to decay no matter how loud I'm playing. So it's really how we put the tones in relationship to each other that we can lie about a swell. Chopin comes as close as anybody writing... So the way we can fake the human voice is to go... And then to increase the left hand so it sounds like the right hand swelled. So you see, we have to manufacture the music in a lot of ways. It is not as natural as some guy just singing the top part and then the other person goes... Oh, it's gorgeous. Even for a bad voice like me to be able to go... Instead of... Because that note in my hearing begins to decay the minute I play it. So how could it be crescendoing to hear if it begins to decay? So I have to fake it by going to bring the left hand in order to do it. So all we're doing is battling against the lack of ability to crescendo and vibrato in the piano. We have to manufacture our way of doing it.
Concert pianist Santiago Rodriguez. On this program, Music and Tools, we're talking about how music is affected when it passes through a medium, the human body, a musical instrument, microphone and amplifier, even the room in which it's heard. To find out more about the biomechanics of music making, we talked to psychologist and ethnomusicologist John Bailey at his home in Brighton, England.
The body is just a tool that you use, and that the sooner you learn to use it in a way that requires minimal attention and so on, the sooner you can get on to what music is really all about, and that is creating sounds, beautiful sounds.
Bailey says that blues guitar is body-rooted, meaning that in the blues style, the hand and guitar fit is more natural than, say, in classical guitar playing. The open bass strings give you the root notes of the 12-bar blues sequence.
The thumb is used, generally speaking, in the country blues style to play a constant pattern on the bass strings. So if I was playing in the key of E, I'd be going like this on the bass strings. On my E note, after the first four bars, when I get to the subdominant chord, I would change that to the A string, also open. And when I need my dominant, I simply put one finger down and I've got the B. Now, in playing on the guitar, blues style, the thumb then is playing the bass part. And the first finger, or first and second fingers, is being used to pick out a melody on the top three strings. Now I'm on to the A.
My own blues. Hold up your head. Darling, you got your chin where mine's supposed to be. Hold up your head. You got your chin where mine's supposed to be. I just wanna lay my head up in your bosom, little girl, that'll be good rest for me. Yeah, have mercy.
Bailey has a term for this interaction between body and instrument.
The dance of the hands. And that in order to get a fully rounded vision of what music making is all about, we need to look at it as well, in a sense, as a choreographic act, as something in which we are using our bodies, and that the way that we move in relation to an instrument has got its own sort of internal logic to it. In other words, there are lots of little details about the way that we move when we're playing an instrument that actually are manifest in the sound. And that's why, if you're having to learn to play the musical instrument of another culture as part of your research or coursework or anything, one of the things you have to do is to move on the instrument in as close a way as possible to the way that the people themselves move. There's no good playing an African instrument like an American body, if you see what I mean. You've got to become an African body to make it right.
This is Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the English Chamber Orchestra in the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Maestro Thomas performs his musical ideas through the minds, bodies, and instruments of many musicians.
Working with a different orchestra is like working with a different troupe of actors. They have their particular strengths, they have their particular styles. You can, to some degree, play with or play against what those strengths are. But finally, they are the ones who have to play the piece. You have a conception of the work which you bring to them, which hopefully unites them in a performance which makes sense, which has a certain kind of conviction. Now, of course, one very effective way the conductors have of doing this is that they bring their own materials to these pieces. Nearly every piece that I'm doing now, wherever I'm going, I'm taking with me sets of parts of my own, which have expression marks, balances, everything indicated quite specifically. When you step in front of an orchestra to create a great piece of music, what you are doing is trying to give the best of your spirit at that particular moment. Very often you're not even aware of exactly what it is that you've said or what you've done or what gestures you've used or anything else. You're really on a very clear, focused track of what the actual stream of consciousness of the music is. And that's where your spirit is, and everything that you do is in service of that.
Musicians have their own instruments, but as a conductor, Michael Tilson Thomas has to adapt quickly to each orchestra and to each hall.
When you go out on stage in a new hall with a new orchestra and you play one chord, you know right away a great deal about what situation you're working with, because you can hear a certain balance that exists within the orchestra, you can hear what the acoustical situation is in that particular hall, and you therefore know a lot about how the music will need to be played in that space with that particular ensemble to create the result you're hoping to achieve.
Earlier in our program, pianist Santiago Rodriguez said he uses certain techniques to overcome problems inherent in his instrument, the piano. Conductors have techniques for dealing with their instrument, the orchestra. One day, David Zinman was rehearsing Pelléas and Mélisande by Fauré. He had a problem.
When we first started recording that first movement, which requires a sort of lovely, sort of velvety sound, it was the first thing, and the orchestra was tight. It had this tight sound, and I was trying to get this lovely, voluptuous sort of string sound. And finally, what I did is I said, look, it's the first thing. Let's play something fast and loud. And we went on to another thing that we were recording, which was Sibelius Pelléas. And then at the end of the session, when they were sort of tired but very relaxed, we did in one take that first movement of the Pelléas and Mélisande Fauré. I once said to a conductor who should be nameless, I said, how do you get that sound? And he says, I want it. And that's just a very basic, primitive, physical thing that is done through gesture. No conductor has two gestures alike, yet they feel some sort of emanation from the conductor, and the conductor is able to achieve the sound he wants because he wants it. You know, I mean, how does a traffic cop lead us through a situation? I mean, you know, a detour in the road. He makes hand signs, he makes eye signs, and somehow you know where he wants you to go. And it's the same with an orchestra.
Zinman says another technique for dealing with the orchestra is psychology.
Someone would say to me in a rather angry tone of voice, well, how do you want that? Loud or soft? And in the past, I would feel his anger, and I would react in an angry way of myself. Well, you know, why are you talking to me this way? You know, now, when that happens, I will just smile at him and say, I'd like it softer, thank you very much. And what they were doing that for is to see if they could get you angry, to see if they could make you do something. And then they realize, well, you know, he's not going to get angry. He's just here to work. And, you know, well, you know, he's not going to do anything strange. So that's the sort of thing that, I mean, dealing positively with almost every situation that arises, in other words, pays good benefits.
In this program, we heard how a musician adapts to his or her instrument as an extension of the human body. and how some instruments are further extended by, say, using a microphone. A pipe organ is designed, built, and voiced for a specific room, so the room becomes an integral part of the instrument. Eileen Gunther is Minister of Music at Foundry United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. She supervised the design and installation of a new organ for the church, built by Cassavant Frere of Quebec, Canada.
People from Cassavant came here because, of course, the building, every instrument is custom built for a room. And the room and the acoustic are extremely important. As it is now, we have about 2.5 seconds of reverberation, about 4 seconds when we take out the pew cushions, the dome. It's a whispering gallery effect like St. Paul's Cathedral in London. So it's a very odd room. Frequencies are not the same in any one place. You have to decide on a place that you're going to listen from and voice for that place. But all of that put together is the artistry of building an organ in a particular room. This instrument has 3,364 pipes. So each of those pipes was treated individually in a process called voicing, which is, you can see, takes a long time. And that is where, if I can say, where the true artistry of a builder comes out. I was around all the time, practically living here with them, listening, saying, that's gorgeous, or golly, that doesn't sound, you know, I think we need a little bit more from that particular pipe.
Earlier in this program, John Bailey talked about the biomechanics of playing blues guitar. If you're an organist, you worry about both hands and both feet and all those keyboards. And you worry about another problem that psychologists might call right-left hand-foot integration.
The problem centers on the fact that you have four extremities, two hands and two feet. Basically, three of them are playing one clef, the bass clef. Your feet read the bass clef most of the time. Your left hand reads the bass clef most of the time. But your right hand reads the treble clef. So this is fairly counterposing to the traditional hemisphere division of left hemisphere influencing your right side. If you've got a stroke on the left side of your brain, it's the right side of your body, your right hand and your right leg that will be affected. So you've got a 3-to-1 kind of thing here. It's very complicated. And it takes, some people can never manage it very well. I mean, if there are people who start the organ and never get very good at it, this could be one of the reasons.
Gunther says what separates the men from the boys is trio playing, which takes on that problem of three limbs versus one. Even a master organist has difficulty tossing off one of these at the drop of a hat.
This is a chorale prelude by Johann Sebastian Bach, of which he wrote, you know, many, many. Rejoice, Beloved Christians is the name of it. The melody, or the cantus firmus in the technical term, is in the pedal, and it goes. Not so terribly tough. The left hand is moving in eighth notes. Also not so tough on its own. The right hand is moving in sixteenths. Now, the trick is putting them all together. And that's where the challenge is. It's a trio in the sense that there are three hands, you know, right hand, left hand, and both of your feet acting as the third voice in this case, playing absolutely different lines. Together they go. Let's do that one again. I can see why it's hard.
Organist Eileen Gunther. There's one modern instrument we can consider which is a tool of our times, and perhaps of the future, the synclavier. You could call it a cross between a computer and a digital recorder, all of it controlled with a piano-type keyboard and a lot of switches. It's a tapeless recording studio, or it's a complex musical instrument for performing live with pre-recorded input. John Appleton was a co-developer of the Synclavier back in the mid-1970s. He says that the turning point in its development came when they found the solution to the learning loop problem. According to Appleton, it takes too long to learn the instrument if it's more than 5 seconds or so between the command and when you hear the sound.
It should really be immediate. And in the early days of computer music, it wasn't just 5 seconds. It could be as much as a few weeks before you heard what you typed out on a terminal.
They needed an immediate feedback, and that's what they got.
This was the first computer music instrument that had ever been built.
The Synclavier, like all the other instruments we've invented, is just another tool, an extension of the human body. But the performer has to learn how to adapt to it.
So that what is required when you play a Synclavier often is to be able to switch your mindset and say, now I'm playing a piano, now I'm playing tabla, now I'm playing violin or string orchestra. And it's not so easy to jump immediately from one kind of technique into another. That's something that can be learned, but it does have to be learned. It isn't automatic. Here's something that for you to think about. The cost of a grand piano doubles every 10 years. The cost of a sophisticated digital instrument that sounds nearly as good as a piano is cut in half every 10 years. That means that in 10 years from now, a Steinway grand will cost $100,000 and a very good digital electronic piano will cost about $1,000. There's no question that digital pianos, whether they look like a piano or not, will be in the place of those copper-wound strings and felt-covered hammers. That won't exist in most homes in 20 years.
Yeah, but how's it going to look in my living room at Boxwood?
You can have a computer circuit board covered in mahogany or ebony and finished however you like.
If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series or information on how to order a cassette or a transcript of this program on music and tools, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Here's that address again. The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Don't forget to mention the call letters of the station you are listening to and the title of this program, Music and Tools. Our program on music and tools is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. John Widoff is the mix engineer. Michael Wilpers is the research assistant. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. This series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. I'm Paul Anthony. This is NPR. National Public Radio.